May it please the court, Randy Alperhasky here for Mr. Malin. Ronald Malin, a correctional officer in Licking, Missouri, has experienced exactly one incident of hypotensive crisis in his entire life. At age 56, he began working for the department at age 48 in 2008, passed a pre-employment physical, and worked there for 3 years before having the crisis, missed 6 weeks of work, returned to work doing the same thing without problems, and continues to work there to this day. If you're like me, you would ask, well, what would cause a hypertensive crisis? And Dr. Kaprovica addressed that in his report and his opinions. It was Dr. Kaprovica's opinion that the mental, psychological, and physical stress were the prevailing factor in precipitating the event of hypertensive crisis. I emphasize the word stress on behalf of Dr. Kaprovica in his terms because he doesn't say exertion, and there's a difference. If you look at the circumstances surrounding the incident, Mr. Malin was working that day in August of 2011 with about 200 inmates in his presence outside the lunchroom when an inmate started acting up. In fact, the inmate refused to follow orders, so Mr. Malin moved towards him. When he did that, the inmate swung his arm back in an attempt to strike Mr. Malin. This was an act of aggression on the part of the inmate, and Mr. Malin immediately took the inmate to the ground, jumping on his back and grabbing his arm so he fell chest to chest, and they both fell on the floor. This was part of the stress that Dr. Kaprovica was talking about, but not all of it, because you have to understand the circumstances. As Dr. Kaprovica put in this report, it was the circumstances around the incident that caused the stress. First, you have the emotional side. Mr. Malin testified that this was an incident where he didn't know what was going to happen, and it caused him an adrenaline rush. Because you don't know, I can't imagine working in a prison, to be honest, but working in a prison, I'm sure, is a high anxiety, stress job to begin with. When you compound that, when you're surrounded by 200 inmates, and you're trying to take someone down, take down an inmate who's being belligerent, who's being combative, the emotional stress skyrockets.
And on factual findings, we're going to defer normally, or do we not defer to what the commission found?
Well, on findings of fact, you defer to the commission, of course. And the commission found in this instance, actually, that there was an accident and that there were objective evidence of injury. First of all, they found that immediately afterwards, he started coughing up blood. How do you cough up blood? It comes from your lungs. That's how you cough up blood. The second thing that they found was that he had difficulty breathing. Well, that goes hand in hand with coughing up blood. That happened immediately after the incident. He'd never experienced either of these things before in his life or since. And if you look at the ER records, when he went to the ER, there's also indication that from the doctor, Dr. Stubbs, that he had severe pulmonary contusions that showed up on the x-ray. That was his opinion. So you have all these indices of injury.
Is this case, from your point of view, really about whether the statement made by the doctor, the causal statement, was adequate? That he wrote that the takedown of the offender is felt to represent the direct, proximate, and prevailing factor in precipitating the employee's hypertensive crisis, and whether that's sufficient to meet the definition of whether it's a prevailing factor?
Well, two things, I guess. You know, the commission said that was somehow ambiguous, or they didn't, even though they were reading it, they somehow didn't believe what was saying. And I think, as a matter of law, they can't do that. They can't infer ambiguity where there's no ambiguity.
Well, why can't they believe all part or none of the testimony from any witness?
They are only free to do that in a case where there's competing doctors to testify.
Why is that? Why can't they? What if there's a one witness case? Why can't they listen to that one witness and
because
it's all part or none of the testimony of any witness?
Because it involves medical expertise. And these judges, these commissions, they aren't experts. They have to defer to a medical expert when it's on the
case. Is there a case that says that you must accept the testimony of an expert and you can't subject it to determine whether you think it's well-supported?
Credibility determination.
Tilson says you cannot substitute ALJ's personal opinion of medical causation for the uncontradicted testimony of an expert.
But is that consistent with the determination, I mean, while we review the evidence for weight of the evidence or findings, haven't we always found that the agency's tribunal, that they can determine credibility?
Only if, in the medical expert's case, if they find that it's inconsistent or impeached. There's no evidence of inconsistency or impeachment here. Furthermore,
what if we don't accept that premise of your statement of the law? What if we believe that they have the right to reject any part or all? Does that leave your argument?
I thought you had an alternative argument.
I do. Let me get to that. First of all, who says prevailing factor is the medical determination? That is nowhere in the statute. The statute says you have to determine whether the prevailing factor under all the circumstances what was the incident at work. That's what's not being done by the commission here. They have not considered all the circumstances beyond the medical opinion. If you look at Leak, the court
I thought here your argument on your brief was not with the fact that the trial court or the commission incorrectly found the facts, but that the commission incorrectly understood his opinion where he said that it was the prevailing and precipitating factor, and the commission focused on the word precipitating and ignored the word prevailing.
That is part, I mean, it's twofold. That's part of it. The first part is that they didn't understand or take the true value of the words as they were on paper. They tried to infer ambiguity where there was no ambiguity. That's the first part.
And what is the effect of that? If in fact that unambiguously meets the standard in the statute, what does that mean? Does that mean we should remand for them to reconsider it under the proper standard, or can we still affirm if we disagree on factual findings, or what is it you're saying the result would be?
I think you have to remand it for a new decision. I think if they're basing their opinions upon guesswork as to what Dr. Kaprovica meant when it's contrary to the plain reading of his report, then they have to go back and make a decision consistent with his report, which is that this incident was the prevailing factor in precipitating, causing, same meaning, same word, synonymous, in causing his injury.
Now, the commission, though, in its report stated that the employee's expert was equivocal at best regarding medical causation. If that's the case, how has the employee met their burden of proof?
Well, I would ask you, where did they get equivocal? I mean,
it's a finding by the commission, don't we have to defer to that?
That's a finding, it's a conclusion. There's nothing in his report that's ambiguous or equivocal.
Well, found equivocal because of the use of both precipitating and prevailing in the same sentence, and that it was not clear, as we've just been talking, it was ambiguous.
If you look at the definition of the term precipitating, it means to cause. It's the same thing. There's no difference between to cause or to precipitate something. They are synonymous terms in the dictionary.
So, we normally interpret the statutes to give meaning to every word, and since the legislature put birth words in, then aren't we compelled to give them different meanings and not have them be synonymous?
Well, here's the distinction. The statute referring to 02.2 refers to that an accident can, the incident cannot be the a precipitating factor, the modifier being a. In this instance, Dr. Kaprovica in his report put down that this was the precipitating factor. There's a difference.
So you're saying here it just happens that it was both.
You said it was
the prevailing factor and, as it happens, the precipitating factor. There's nothing inconsistent in being both those at the same time.
Exactly, and the commission recognized that as much. They just couldn't get over the fact that he's precipitating. It was an unfortunate, because he's not aware of the statute. It doesn't know, precipitating cause to him is synonymous, but to the commission, I think they got a little spooked by that word.
So your argument is that by their use of precipitating, they're not using it in the statutory sense. They are using it in a layman's sense.
Of course. This is a medical doctor. He's not a lawyer or a judge.
Couldn't you have straightened that out if you had called him and had him elaborate on what his opinion was and subjected that opinion to cross-examination?
Well, it was subjected to cross-examination. They had the right under 287, 220 to cross-examine any report. In hindsight, I would do 100 things differently. But, even if I'd done that, that report would still be there, still be in evidence. It wouldn't change anything materially. I mean...
It is. Didn't the commission basically say that, that they looked at that as alternative? They thought it was all, it could be interpreted to mean in the alternative.
Well, I think they looked at it and they confused it with 020.2, where it disqualifies a precipitating factor, and that confused them. I think the terminology, the legal terminology used by a medical doctor confused them, but it wasn't legal terminology in Dr. Paprika's sense. He wasn't trying to make a legal opinion. That's not his place. He was making a medical determination.
Does anything in the statute say something that's a precipitating factor cannot be considered, or is it just that that's not enough? It has to be prevailing to.
Just that that's not enough. It cannot be a precipitating factor. That's not.
Well, it can be a, can't it? It's just that's not adequate in and of itself.
I mean, exactly.
The fact if it was the last cause, does that preclude recovery, or is that simply inadequate to meet your burden of proof without also showing it was the prevailing factor?
I don't think it precludes recovery at all. I just think that if that's all you have, if you just have a precipitating factor, not the prevailing precipitating factor, that, then that's not enough. You have to have prevailing. And that's what Dr. Kopravica put in his report. And prevailing factor, again, is not just a medical determination. That is clear
Couldn't
in the statute.
Couldn't you have a precipitating factor and it be a prevailing factor also?
Exactly. It can be both precipitating and prevailing, that they're not exclusive. Precipitating just means the cause, to make it happen in a hurry. These are all, you know, we were lawyers. We love dealing with definitions and words, but real life isn't like that, you know. And Dr. Kopravica, I wish he hadn't used the term, but he did. That's the way he, you know, it's a term readily used.
Well,
and
what puts us in a better position to determine the weight of his testimony than the commission?
You're not weighing. You're not weighing testimony. You're interpreting it, and they were guessing and speculating as to what he meant when it's not what is on paper. I mean, there's no speculation when he wrote that.
Is there anything in their report that indicated that they were making a credibility determination, that they disbelieved his testimony, that it was a prevailing factor?
No, the only thing they do is they reverse the ALJ's finding that Dr. Percelli, I can't say her name, was more credible. It said specifically she was not because she didn't even
that
understand.
That was the employer's expert?
Yes. And she was not at all credible because she didn't know that he'd taken this prisoner down, that there was distress. The only thing they do in the footnote, and this is why I brought up earlier, in the footnote they point out that Dr. Kopravica, in his history from the claimant, put down that he used a lot of exertion to take the claimant down. Well, in Dr. Kopravica's opinion, he never says exertion is what caused this. He says it was stress, physical and emotional, both. And that's what everyone seems to ignore in this case, is the emotional stress involved in taking down a prisoner in front of 200 other prisoners who may at any time riot. That is a huge part of this case, and I think the commission ignored that, and they have to weigh all the circumstances when they're interpreting the doctor's opinions, not just the doctor's opinion in isolation.
Thank you. Your time is up. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Catherine Goodnight for the Department of Corrections, respondents. The appellant in this case is asking that you modify his burden of proof and thus modify the burden of proof in every workers' compensation case going forward. How? By asking you to find that almost is enough, and the language of the statute is a suggestion more than a standard, and the language of our experts is a good idea that only need get us close enough to the law. 287.020.2 is clear. It states, an injury is not compensable because work was a triggering or precipitating factor. Point three goes on to say that an injury by accident is compensable only if the accident is the prevailing factor in causing both the resulting medical condition and disability.
Going back to Judge Stiss's question.
Yes.
She said, can you have something be both prevailing and precipitating?
Absolutely.
And precipitating is the lower of the standard. Is
yes,
that
ma'am.
Correct?
That is correct.
So if something is precipitating, it also can be prevailing, and prevailing is the required standard and the higher standard.
Yes, you can have a multitude of precipitating factors. However, the accident has to rise as a precipitating factor to be the prevailing factor, which is defined.
Because precipitating really means the last, the precipitating, the one that the ultimate factor that caused whatever it was.
Right. What
and that
it
may
off.
Or may not also be the prevailing factor.
Correct.
Why didn't the doctor here, though, say it was both prevailing and precipitating when he said is felt to represent the direct, proximate, and prevailing factor in precipitating the event?
That is a question we don't know the answer to. I don't know.
Why don't the words themselves provide the answer is what I'm asking you.
Well,
what's unclear about that?
What's unclear about it is just what was pointed out earlier. It's an equivocal opinion, and because we don't know what he meant.
But why is it equivocal? Tell me what's equivocal about it. I'm trying to, this is the heart of your argument. Tell me what's equivocal about it, please.
What's equivocal is that all of those words are used. And because those words are standards in the statute. And
so if I said this is a prevailing and precipitating factor, that would be an equivocal and ambiguous opinion?
Well, if you said prevailing and precipitating, yes.
So there's something about the way they said it. Can you tell me what it is?
He said the prevailing factor precipitating the hypersensitive crisis. He doesn't say that the takedown is the prevailing factor in the resulting medical condition and disability, and that's what the statute requires. Those are the words of our legislature.
Are you drawing a distinction between the hypertensive crisis and something else that was the injury and disability?
Well,
let me ask it this way. What was the injury and what was the disability that had to have been caused as a precipitating factor by the accident?
Well, at the end of the ER visit, Mr. Malum has 10 different diagnoses. And all of those diagnoses, well, not all of them, a number of them were pre-existing for him. He comes out with acute pulmonary edema, acute respiratory failure, acute left ventricle systolic heart failure, probable cardiomyopathy, hypertension.
And he's not claiming for any of those except for the event that occurred that day. Is that correct?
But all of those things are together. All of those things are his resulting medical condition and his disability that led to the medical expenses that he's asking for the state to pay.
So you're questioning not the responsibility for the hypertensive event, but that some of these things aren't related to it, or are you questioning both? I mean, I don't think he's claiming those conditions were caused by the hypertensive event, but you're saying some of his medical costs were related to those other conditions, or are you saying none of his medical costs were related to the hypertensive event?
I mean, I don't know that we parsed apart the medical bills. I think that the medical bills address everything, but the resulting injury and disability is all of those things bound up together. And there's not been any opinion, and this case is saturated with medical evidence. There has been no opinion, including that of Dr. Koprivica, that says the one-arm takedown that the appellant described as taking a 1 to 2 on a scale of 1 to 10 of effort, that it...
Well, there was also evidence that it was a 6 on a scale of 10, and then there was testimony about the emotional stress, and the commission did find that this accident occurred. I know you contested that, but they found, in fact, that it did occur. So
well,
don't we have to assume that in reviewing this, not your 1 and 2, which they rejected?
And I don't think that we have to deny that he had an accident at work. I think you can have an accident. That's what Armstrong says, that you can have an accident at work and still not have a compensable case. That it still has to, all of the number one thing has to be the accident. It's not just because you happen to have an accident at work. It's not a timeline. It's not a location. It's not a lack of an explanation. It has to rise above and still be the prevailing factor. And we don't have any medical expert to link all those things together and say, yes, this takedown was the prevailing factor. We have a lot of factors here to consider, but I don't know that any of the medical experts, and there were a number of them.
What about the statement I read that says the takedown of the offender is felt to represent the direct, proximate, and prevailing factor in precipitating the hypertensive crisis, and that's what he's asking for recovery for, the hypertensive crisis, or the symptoms that preceded it, not the other conditions you're talking about?
Well, there's still nothing linking the hypertensive crisis to the takedown, that the takedown was the prevailing factor in causing the hypertensive crisis. I mean, yes, Dr. Koprivica uses all of those words, but because we don't know what he meant by all those words, and those are not our questions to answer, the burden of proof is on the employee. I don't think, just as Mr. Albertowski's arguing, we can't insert our own interpretation onto Dr. Koprivica. We have to ask him, and he just simply wasn't asked here.
Now, under our standard of review of looking at the whole record,
Yes.
Do we look at, excuse me, do we look at the testimony of the treating physicians?
Yes, we do. And I don't know that they were, they were not deposed either, lack of depositions in this case. But they do say that he did not sustain trauma. None of them give a direct opinion. Dr. Woods, who was one of the ER physicians, said that his condition was not related to trauma, that trauma may have, again, that magic word, precipitated the medical processes he was already experiencing. Dr. Hamm, another one of the treating physicians, said it was unclear which of all of these things made this happen, whether it tipped him into heart failure because of a pre-existing, if he had a pulmonary contusion, or if it was the stress from the event. He just couldn't point to one, and that's critical here.
Could you address the second argument made in Appellant's brief that the findings by the doctors that as a result of the event he had some bruising, injury to his knee, bleeding, emotional stress, those themselves are compensable whether or not the allegedly resulting hypertensive stress, hypertensive crisis actually occurred as a result of those injuries?
Yes. The bruising is an interesting question because the claimant only noticed the bruising after he woke up a week later in the hospital. And two of the different physicians that treated him in the ER that were the actual treating physicians at the time did not find bruising or trauma. They did find something going on with his knee, some scraping, bruising type on the knee, but not anything on his chest.
And the bleeding, the coughing up blood, and the shortness of breath, so he had to be taken by ambulance to the hospital. Why weren't those compensable events?
Dr. Percelli thought that the excess amounts of water he was drinking leading up to the event, in the days leading up to the event, he was drinking over 5 liters of water a day, which for excessive thirst, which could have been a symptom of his uncontrolled diabetes. And she felt as though that could have induced the hypertensive crisis as well and led to the pulmonary event and the spitting up of blood. As far as...
And the timing of it right after, immediately after the takedown?
It wasn't immediately after the takedown. There was an issue with the timeline as to how much time actually passed. And I think that the timeline is important in the prevailing factor, but I think that the question of prevailing factor, while it's not in and of itself a medical determination, it does hinge on a medical determination. And because we don't have one single doctor in this case telling us that the takedown is the prevailing factor.
Well, what about the commission's finding that it was? That not in the hypertensive, but that the incident August 12 was unexpected, traumatic, identifiable by time and place of occurrence, and produced at the time objective symptoms of an injury caused by a specific event during a single work shift. We therefore conclude that the employee suffered an accident.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. That is the definition of an accident, but as I stated, the Armstrong court said that you can have an accident at work, but it doesn't mean it's compensable. To be compensable, it has to be the prevailing factor in causing the resulting disability and injury, and if it doesn't meet those criteria, then you don't get benefits under the statute.
The commission found that the employee's doctor lacked credibility because she relied upon untrue facts or facts not supported in the record. Didn't the doctor for the employer also do the same thing?
The doctor for the employer, Dr. Percelli,
vice versa. They found Dr. Percelli to be not credible, but the doctor for the employee also relied on some of the same untrue facts. True.
There were some hiccups, shall we say, in some of the facts. But Dr. Kuprovica was under the impression that this takedown required a great amount of effort, that it caused him immediate bruising, which, in the words of his own patient or his own client, was not true. Dr. Percelli agreed with claimant, took his testimony at face value and said it took minimal effort, took into account all of the pre-existing medical conditions, took into account his excess thirst that was causing him to drink all this water, and truly considered all of those surrounding circumstances or all of the factors, and then said she just couldn't say that the takedown itself was enough to kick off this hypertensive crisis.
And is that was the employer's doctor?
Yes, Dr. Percelli
and
was.
And do we, what did the commission find about the credibility of that opinion?
I believe that the commission, even though they may not have come down and said she is the one, they said that there's no one in this case that can point to the prevailing factor and allow them to render an opinion in favor of the appellant.
But they said she should not be believed.
No, she should be believed.
No, they said they rejected her opinion because...
They did reject her. I thought you were asking if she should be believed now, and yes, she should. But I think that because none of the doctors, even the doctors that immediately treated him, that saw him right then when it was going on, that they couldn't tell, yes, he had a takedown. This is what caused this. This is what caused this medical condition and what may or may not be later resulting disability. Unfortunately, Mr. Malum didn't have a lot going on afterwards. Like Randy said, he's back to work as a corrections officer, and that's very fortunate for him. But what was going on right then at that moment, that hypertensive crisis that caused him to be taken from the facility in an ambulance, that caused him to spit up blood, very severe symptoms, no one can tell us that the prevailing, or chooses to tell us that the prevailing factor is the takedown that caused all of that.
The standard we have is that we examine the whole record to see whether the award is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence.
Yes.
So we aren't bound by the commission's determination that the fact that he had an event that caused him within a relatively short period of time to begin coughing up blood and required him to go to the hospital and he was in a coma for a week, that factor can inform all that evidence we weigh in determining whether we think there's sufficient evidence to support an award.
Yes, I think that when you look at the record as a whole, just as several of the doctors did, as far as the...
There's only one doctor who wasn't found to be credible, is that right? That wasn't found to be incredible?
I believe that's correct. Yes,
and that's his position?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so we don't even... The other ones, we've had a credibility finding that causes us to discount their
evidence. I don't know if there was
evidence.
A specific credibility finding for doctors Wood or Ham, who were the initial treating physicians. I don't know that okay. The court came out and made a determination on those gentlemen.
And your opponent argues that we should consider circumstantial evidence. Do you agree with that?
I think even if you consider all of the circumstantial evidence, you'll come to the same conclusion that the commission did. There's not enough circumstantial evidence to determine that the prevailing factor was the takedown. The takedown was described earlier as having taken place in front of 200 inmates. Mr. Malum testified that he knew this guy. That's why he went up to him when he was acting out in the dining hall. He went up to him, he calls him outside, they're in the hallway, and that's when he makes a motion with his arm like he's going to strike Mr. Malum, and Mr. Malum takes him down with one arm and falls down on top of him. There's some dispute in the record as to whether or not the offender actually fell on top of Mr. Malum, which Mr. Malum and the witness that was deposed said didn't happen. And so I'm sure it was stressful. I've never been a DOC officer, and I admire the work that they do, but it just was not this huge event that's been described. It was very minimal in effort, 1 to 2 out of 10, took a few minutes, and then he rose of his own power, he assisted the offender in rising, and then escorted him to another area for search. And then sometime later has the hypertensive crisis. It was not immediate.
And do you agree that we can consider, the stress of it besides the physical nature of the altercation?
I think in order to make a correct determination of the prevailing factor, you have to consider everything. You have to consider the stress. You have to consider the physicality. You have to consider everything that was already going on, all the medical processes that were already going on with Mr. Malum. And then after you consider all of those things, you have to make a determination that the takedown was a prevailing factor in order to find his case to be compensable. That's what the statute requires. And I think that if you do that, then Mr. Malum wins. And if you don't, then just as the ALJ said, just as the commission said, just as the Southern District said, he does not have a compensable case.
And do you believe it is a question of law as to whether the evidence that is in the record meets the standard?
I do. I believe that it's a burden of proof question, as I stated in my opening. And I think that if it's not found that this opinion is equivocal, that of Dr. Papravica, I think it will alter the burden of proof required in all the cases going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counselor, this is a multiple witness case, lots of at least competing testimony in some regards. But what about the case decisions that where there's even just one expert witness and the finder of fact just decides not to believe that expert witness. Why don't those cases control the outcome of this one?
Well, if you look at Tillotson and Copeland, it says that where the commission cannot ignore competent evidence of a witness who is not impeached. The commission cannot base findings on personal belief or conjecture.
And what's the date on that case?
That was the Copeland case, and
I was looking at the Siefner case cited in the Court of Appeals opinion, the
2006. Sorry.
Yeah, I was looking at the Siefner case, second injury fund case out of the Western District in 2012. But haven't we had some cases which are one witness cases where the party of the burden of proof just loses?
Certainly, and that's where the witness was found to be credible, and there were findings that backed that up. Are incredible. There was a basis, and it was not arbitrary on the commission's part to form an opinion about the witness. The commission cannot be arbitrary. They cannot perform guesswork. They cannot imbue ambiguity where there is none. That is not their job. If the doctor says that, a medical doctor with expertise says that this was the prevailing factor in causing or precipitating the incident, then they have to accept that if it's unimpeached.
You know, is that consistent with this court's, like, direct revenue case, the White case?
I'm not familiar with that case.
Administrative law case.
I can only cite to the cases I have in my brief, to be honest. And it's Tillotson, it's consistent with that, which is a more recent case, I think 2012 or so.
You know, has your doctor testified to the commission before, either in writing or orally in other cases?
Certainly, he's well known to the commission.
Well, couldn't they also think that he was well, you know, familiar with the standard of causation and had met it in some cases in the past and had not met it in some cases, but here had tried to draw a line too fine for the commission? Isn't that possible?
Well, I think it's possible that they were. I can't speak to what was in the commission's head. All I can do is what's on paper and what the court has before it, the evidence here. You know, and the report itself is unambiguous. The doctor doesn't use, you know, it was a precipitating factor. He uses the precipitating factor. You know, to guess, you know, if I'm going to guess anything, like I said before, I think the commission was spooked by the use of the term precipitating. But that doesn't change anything under the law or the common use definition of precipitating. You know, and he's not the only one to say that. I mean, Dr. Woods in the ER report says the trauma precipitated the medical process. Well, trauma, that's defined as a deeply disturbing experience, one, or a physical injury. He qualifies for both of those. Under Dr. Wood's testimony or opinion in his records, this, you know, there's a trauma that occurred which would qualify as a compensable injury, and anything that followed that trauma would be, under Tillotson, the medical bills would be compensable as well, if they're reasonable and necessary to help cure and relieve.
What was the injury, just so we're clear, in the claim? There has to be an injury and disability. So what was the injury and what was the disability?
Well, you don't allege injuries in a claim. You allege body parts, and you allege how the accident or injury occurred, but you don't allege the actual injury. It's not required.
Well, under the statute, what is it that has to have been the accident was the prevailing cause of what?
Of an injury.
What? Okay, and what was the injury?
That's a good question. The commission didn't answer that. All they did is concentrate on hypertensive crisis. You know, I would say the injury was spitting of blood. Injury could be contusions to the lungs, which were found by the ER doctor. The injury could be the emotional shock as well. There are a number of injuries that occurred here. I find it unfathomable that there could be a finding in this case that there was no injury. There was an injury. You don't take a person down. I'm an ex-wrestler. You don't take them down in a prison and start coughing up blood and having trouble breathing without a medical condition existing. There is an injury. I think sometimes we get bogged down in the trees of statutory interpretation and words and parsing, and we lose the whole principle of what's behind workers' compensation. And that's the whole idea, is to compensate individuals who are hurt on the job. And I know it's not that simple for you or for me, for anyone, but that is the principle. You know, this individual, this corrections officer, was injured, put in the hospital for a week, and almost died because he was putting his life on the line for his work. And I don't think it's a fact to be lost.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.